Well, we're in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians 8. Seeming, actually, you know, 8 and 9 all go together, or half of 9 at least. They have to do with an offering, a collection that, you know, was taken for the church at Jerusalem. We don't really know the full extent of, you know, what the problems in Jerusalem were. We do know from early Acts that you had a lot of people that came to Jerusalem for the Pentecost. You'd had a lot of people come for the Passover, and then you had the crucifixion of Christ. But then you had a large group that came for the Pentecost, which may have been a larger group. And then you have Peter's sermon at Pentecost. You have the outpouring of the Spirit. You have the beginning of the church. And you have these mass conversions. It's a little hard for us to imagine. You know, we kind of think of it in terms of evangelism, like a Billy Graham crusade. And you have this, you know, football field full of mainly believers, but a lot of people that are coming forward. And it would somewhat be like that, but not really, because at that time, other than the disciples and a few others, there weren't any what we would call believers. But yet at the same time, they weren't necessarily lost as we would normally think of it. Because you have people that are God-fearers, they believe in God, they're faithful to God, they are pursuing God, but you have a transition that's taken place where we've always looked forward to the Messiah coming. Now the Messiah has been here. And so the transition is, you know, do you accept this one Jesus as the Messiah? And you had mass conversions. You had the huge, what does it talk about, like 3,000 people accept. Well, when we hear that, you know, if we put it in our terminology, it's a little incorrect in one sense, because it's not like if you went down the mall and somebody saying, "I reject God," and you preach a sermon and they go, "I accept God." These, you know, a large number of these people were, in one sense, or I mean truly, they were faithful followers, but now there's something new. The message is new. It's the Messiah. And so it brings them into that sense of what we would call believers. So many people didn't go home. There's this revival that breaks out, and we hear about these from time to time. There was a revival in Canada, the early 70s. I'm not sure the date. I've read it before. But it started at one church. They had a speaker come in, and it just this spontaneous revival. I don't mean revival like the scheduled revival that we used to grow up in. Every spring somebody, you know, a church would be having a revival. But this was true revival. And there were so many people come to this church that they asked another church if they could meet there. And then that church got, and it just kind of kept going. One of the speakers, the church it started at, he was talking about that the fire marshal came and said, "You cannot have this many people in here." He said, and then the fire marshal got saved and said it didn't matter. But you've heard probably of Henry Blackaby and his book about experiencing God. Well, he wasn't at the church where the revival started, but he was in that town, and it spilled over, and his church became one of the churches involved. And so it was very broad. And then it moved even into the United States. And it really picked up some stuff within Methodist circles at a Methodist college, and it spread through some Methodists. It came to the Southwest mainly through Southern Baptist. And if you remember, there was something, especially in Southern Baptist circles, called lay witness movement. When I became a Christian, this is where I got involved, and actually, you know, was not exactly sure when I became a Christian in this period, but when I, you know, started seeking a change, from my perspective, seeking a change in my life, went to this lay witness mission, and I was in Lubbock, Texas, and I was giving my testimony, and I'm like, somewhere in this past month, something, you know, I've become a believer. But but lay witness movement. Well, it all came from that sense of revival. Well, so at Pentecost, you have all these people, and it's in that sense of a revival. And as things do, as this one in Canada, people kept coming and it kept spilling over. Well, people didn't want to go home. And so we see this early in Acts where they say, you know, the apostles say, well, you know, somebody needs to take care of feeding these people. And we don't have time to be doing it. You need to appoint some, you know, what become deacons. They're really just servants, but they appoint Stephen and various people, men filled with the Spirit, to oversee this distributing of food. Well, it wasn't food for the people that live there. It was these people that are coming in that don't have it. Then you have people giving stuff away. So you have Ananias and Sapphira. Other people were giving things away, so they come in and they say, we sold our land, we're giving it all to the church, which wasn't true, and that's where they got in trouble. Nobody forced them, nobody even asked them necessarily to sell their land. They could have sold it and said, we're giving half, and that would have been an incredibly gracious gift. But it was the lying that was the issue there. But that's why that was going on. Now, this is sometime later, so it's not exactly the same setting, but it's somewhat the same scenario that there's a need in Jerusalem. It could be that the economic situation has changed so that that church is really undergoing persecution. There could be some things that are related to because you're believers. You know, this is what Paul was doing. Paul was persecuting those of the church when he was converted. So you have a situation in Jerusalem where there's a great need. And so there's been an appeal to the churches to support. So when we read these passages, they become a foundation for mission work. They become a foundation for, contributing to your local church, for the support of your local church, supporting missionaries. All of that is applicational. That's not its primary meaning. So if you're going to deal with things in terms of text that says this is the primary meaning, and so primary meaning really would only go to that first generation, that early church. But then you have an application, and then you have kind of a applications that move to other strata, if you would, almost, that you as you make kind of movements towards something. The issue here was Christians in need. So this would most, if we wanted to make a direct application, this would be, hurricane. Or, you know, in this area, tornadoes hit, you know, somewhere in Kansas. It's a sister church type thing. There's some Bible churches there where that we're associated with or know about. And those believers there are in great need. And so we collect money and we give it to John, and John takes it up there for us and distributes it to the people. That would be the most direct application. Well, in our nation, that type of stuff doesn't happen a great deal because of government and various things. But the application then becomes of collections, of giving money to support something. So maybe it's support your local church, maybe it's support missionary. But those can become more the second and the third applicational steps. So somewhere along the line, sometime before, a year before, an appeal had been made to the churches. And those at Corinth took this up. Now, once again, there's no requirement. No, Paul wasn't going to Corinth. There's nothing to indicate that Paul, you know, came in like to our group and said, okay, this is what I expect of you. You know, I hacked into the IRS accounts. I know what your income is, and this is what you're expected. There are some churches, except for the hacking into IRS accounts, that's basically what they do from people I've talked to that attend churches like that, that annually, there's a board that sits around and they say, I think Belinda could give us this much money. I think Susie could give us this much money. And they send them basically an invoice. You sound like someone from personal experience. So there are perks to following the system, huh? So now, if you grow up in that system, then you're not offended because that's what you were used to. If you go to one of those churches and you don't know anything about that system, you've never been around that system, and you get basically what you interpret as an invoice, you're greatly offended. That's what I've been told by some, that were greatly offended because that wasn't their system. Well, Paul, there's no reason to think that Paul went to Corinth and said, I expect $100,000. I don't care how you get it. I want it. Well, I'll be back. Have it. No, they said, we want to help. We make a pledge. And there's really nothing wrong with making pledges. Now, pledges can be interpreted a couple of ways. Sometimes, you know, we could say, okay, we want to help a missionary. What would you pledge? And if you see that pledge in the sense of, you know, some type of a commitment that's ironclad, a promise to God, then that's a little different. You know, so I get you all emotionally excited to do something, and so you make these pledges that are really responding out of emotion. Well, that's a misuse of things. But maybe we're talking about what our intent is, what our desires are. If God would allow, if God will provide for us, we intend to support this missionary by $500 a month next year. And that, and we've all made various pledges, and that's my pledge. So I pledge $25 a month. But then it turns out I'm not able to do it. But, you know, if we're talking about that kind of a pledge, it's not a promise. I'm not breaking a promise to God. We're talking about what our desires are if God provides, if things are there. Well, that's how I understand here. They've made a pledge. They've said, this is what we want to do. Well, now the time has come. It's a reminder, and it's also, Paul saying, you get this together. You know, let's renew this. Let's get it together. And then he tells about some other churches, which are phenomenal. One of the ones we'll see in here talks about the church in Macedonia. That, and this is one of the often cited passages, you know, when you're looking at this chapter, is that it'll say here that out of their poverty, they begged, they asked if they could help out. And so you're talking about somebody that's saying, you know, we're in a drought. You know, this is a great recession. We're in a depression. We don't really have much money, but we want to help. So we're going to scrape together our pennies and we're going to help. And that's kind of what this church, and Paul points them out as, you know, as a model, because they desired to give out of their poverty. Well, that's just a broad sense of an overview. So this evening, I want to just look at this just a little bit more and not look at it in detail, but just kind of the broad picture. And then we'll come back and look at these in a little more detail. So in chapter 8 and verse 1, it says, now, brethren, we wish to make known to you the grace of God, which has been given in the churches of Macedonia. One of the things we'll notice throughout this is the talking about the grace of God. You know, people are being appealed to give money. Those in Macedonia have given money even though they're in great poverty. But it's because of God's grace. It's a response of grace, but it's also a recognition what we have is because of God's grace. And so he goes on to explain this grace, this grace of God in verse 2. He says, that in great ordeal of affliction. Now, think about that concept. Great ordeal of affliction. Well, that's, while I don't know exactly what was going on, those are pretty strong terms. And then he goes, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty. Those are contradictory terms normally. Their deep poverty, but yet an abundance of joy, overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. This is kind of like the woman when Jesus is with his disciples and people are giving, and some are given to show off, and some are given maybe actually a large amount, but it's a very small amount of what they have. And then some lady comes up and gives her last two pennies. The amount she's given is not much. But it just happens in terms of percent to be everything she has. She's given 100%. You know, if you want to use the cliche of sports, you know, she's given 110%. She's given everything she has and a little more. Well, here, notice the terms. Out of their deep poverty, overflowed the wealth of their liberality. Well, it's not overflowed the wealth of their monetary monies in terms of that there was some bucket and it just overflowed, but out of deep poverty, their liberty to give was incredible. So it's kind of like that picture of the lady given the 2 cents. They are in deep poverty, but they want to participate, as he goes on. He says, verse 3, for I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, They gave of their own accord. And that becomes the issue. See, the issue in church, the issue with God in terms of finances isn't the amount I give, per se. It has to do with what my ability is. And so if your ability, let's say your ability is $100, and you give $1, and somebody else's ability is $10, and they give $1, there's a great difference. They're both given $1, or you could say one's given $10, but it's the ability. That's what he's looking at. You know, their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord. So he's not talking about the amount. It probably was small amounts, but it was a great accord. And then notice this in verse 4, begging us with much urgency for the favor of participation. That's the concept here. They wanted to participate so much, they are begging, please let us help. Please let us help. They gave of their own accord, begging us with much urgency, or urging, for the favor of participation and the support of the saints. And this, not as we had expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. So we urged Titus that he had previously made a beginning, so he would also complete it in you, this gracious work as well. So Paul throws them up as a model. Here are some people that were in great poverty, and they wanted to give. Now, you've made a pledge, and we've sent Titus to complete this. He moves on in verse 7, says, but just as you abound in everything, in faith, in utterance, in knowledge, and in all earnestness, and in the love we inspired in you, see that you abound in this gracious work also. I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. So there's no command here, but this is an appeal so people will recognize their love. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. What a beautiful theological picture. Christ, who was everything, and we see this in Philippians, he has everything, but yet in some sense that we can never totally comprehend, I don't know if we can partially, but it's a very small part in my mind that I comprehend, that Christ in one sense set aside what it was to be God. Now he can't do that totally because he's still God, but in one sense, almost, you know, an overstatement, but as the Charles Wesley song was, he gave away everything except love. Well, I don't think that's actually theologically correct because he's still God, but it gives you a picture. He sets aside everything and became like you and me, except for the sin. He became a mere human. So he leaves his estate in heaven to become poor, if you would. And out of his poverty of being human, though sinless human, he gave us the most precious, wealthy gift you can give, salvation. So we became rich because he became poor. He moves on, he says, I give my opinion in this matter, for this is to your advantage, you who were first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but also because you desire to do it. So it's your advantage to follow through with what the pledge was. But now finish doing it also, so that just as there was the readiness to desire it, so there may also be the completion by your ability. For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what he does not have. For this is not the ease of others and for your affliction, but by way of equality. At this present time, your abundance being a supply for their need, so that their abundance also may become a supply for your need, that there may be equality. Just as is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little had no lack. Do you know what that's a reference to? Okay, to the manna. Remember on the manna, you were supposed to go out every morning and you would pick up, but what you pick up is going to be enough. And the person that picked up a whole bunch had enough. The person that wasn't able to pick up quite as much, had enough. And if you tried to hoard it, it wasn't a good thing. But that's the he's speaking of this sense of equality. Now, just like in Acts, I don't think the picture here is that we are supposed to be some type of a commune that share everything alike, and so we put it all in a big pot, and somebody goes in there and divides it up, and everybody gets an equal share. But it is in the sense of saying that when there are these needs, that when you give, God provides for you. Now, you can see in some of this the idea of prosperity theology. There are elements of prosperity theology that they push that are correct. And there's some of that that we neglect to emphasize correctly. In my opinion, they overstep it so much that it just destroys it all. It's not the sense of saying here that if you have something, therefore it's a sign that God blessed you. If you don't have it, it's a sign that God has cursed you. That would be the opposite of what this passage is saying. But it is saying that when people see needs and they give, that God still provides for them. Matter of fact, in Philippians, I believe the way that to understand a part of that passage in Philippians where he's talking about, where Paul's talking about, I've had much and I've had little, and he goes through and he's talking about the blessings, the provisions for the Philippians, that God will provide your needs. And we see this kind of, you know, quoted that I can do all things through Christ. You know, you see some football player that's, you know, just won the game. All I was thinking of, I can do all things through Christ, you know, and you're just kind of going, I wonder what happened if the defensive player was saying the same thing. You know, I mean, you know, if both players on opposite sides are saying it, does that really work? Well, that's not the application there. But I think when you look at that, you know, one of the things there is if you look at the Philippians through that letter, Paul talks about they renewed their ability to give. They always wanted to help Paul. They just didn't have the opportunity. And so one of our needs in life is to have enough money to actually be able to help people, actually be able to share. And, you know, that's if you have the right attitude. Now, I think I mentioned before, we had a relative that wrote and said, please pray that God would make me rich because I want to help people. Do I really believe that one? I don't think so. You know, so you hear somebody once in a while say, you know, if I could just win the lottery, I would tithe. You know, if I won $1 million, I would gladly give my 10%. Well, yeah, because you get to keep $900,000. I don't think that's how it works. But there is that sense that God provides for us so that we can do those things. Or when we do those things, God provides them in that sense. Though the provision might be through someone else, as he's saying here, through them. Then he moves on to verse 16. He says, but thanks be to God who puts the same earnestness on your behalf in the heart of Titus. For he not only accepted our appeal, but being himself very earnest, he has gone to you of his own accord. We have sent along with him the brother whose fame in the things of the gospel has spread through all the churches. And not only this, but he is also appointed by the churches to travel with us in this gracious work, which is beginning administered by us for the glory of the Lord himself and to show our readiness, taking precautions so that no one will be discredited or discredit us in the administration of his generous gift. So Paul's going on to say there's a caravan of us coming so that there's appropriate safeguards and that no one can be accused of anything and that this money will end up where it's supposed to be. But what we see in this is an appeal to support believers that are in need. And the example becomes a group of believers that are in great poverty, but ask, can we please help? Even though we don't have much, and even though we couldn't give much, can we please help? There is a sense that when missionaries come, you know, that they're trying to raise support, that's, you know, the thing that anybody's going to say in that setting is, well, what we really covet most of all is your prayers. And, you know, those kind of statements at times just become what you say. They're almost, if you would, politically correct. But from time to time, you run into people that they really believe that, and you can tell. You know, one of the things that I'd experienced in churches was You ask somebody, would you teach Sunday school? And they go, well, let me pray about it. That means, let me sound spiritual so I can get out of your presence and hopefully you'll forget it. Because I have no intention of teaching Sunday school. I have no intention of praying about it. But I want to sound spiritual. In South Dakota, when somebody told me that, they meant they were going to go pray about it. It was a different culture there. It was serious. When they said they would pray about it, I always had the feeling that they were actually going to go pray about it. Sometimes I've heard missionaries, they say, what we really covet is your prayers. You know, if you can't commit anything, well, that's not really why we're here. We first want your prayers. Well, you know, you could be in that set, you know, I'm going to change application a little bit, where you're saying, I really don't have anything I can't give, but I could pray for you. Well, those in Macedonia were in that situation where anybody would say, there's nothing you can give. And they were saying, but we want to give something. What we can give is not much, but we want to give something. Please let us help. And Paul says, that's a model. That's a model. So anyway, we'll try to look at this. We will look at this passage and break it down a little bit more. But just trying to get an overview of where it all goes this evening. Are there prayer requests?